All right, I want to talk to you now, this morning, the 24th of October, 1955, for the 4th London ACC, concerning the uses of processes which you already know about. Tremendous number of processes which have been put out in the last 5 years. First and foremost of these processes today is creative processing. It's an interesting one. It has been done and has achieved successful results on very many people, has changed many, many cases, and actually is the subject of a book called Self-Analysis, which has done very well for the last 3 years since it was put out in that form. And the fate of creative processing is to be revived at level 3 of 6 levels of processing. That's its fate. Now, usually we pick up a process and then throw it away, you see, and pick it up a little bit tardily again, you know, a little later, and then we throw it away, and so on. Well, really, creative processing has not altered very much. We said a long time ago that if you would work with this book, Self-Analysis, for quite a while, you eventually would exteriorize somebody. See, I just happen to know that. And it's very odd that I happen to know that and not know exactly why. And now all of a sudden we know why. And the why of this is fabulously interesting. It's that, in creative processing, we were actively creating and remedying scarcity of terminals. We created terminals and we rendered their scarcity null and void. Now, we discover that two-way communication, as is, if you were to simply keep on talking on good two-way communication basis, you would eventually discover that you didn't have any mass to talk with. Two-way communication, as is. And the reason it as is quite interesting. Now, you can think of all the mechanics you want to, and you can dream up all of the rationale you want to back of this, and you can give it all the significances you want to, but there's an oddity here that two-way communication would as is anything, because it doesn't happen to matter what postulate the mass was put up with. We put up this mass with some sort of basic postulate or another, and then we run two-way communication with or through this mass and discover that it is diminishing. It's one of the more fabulous things, see? I mean, it didn't matter what reason you marked it up or what postulates or considerations got it there, the end product was the two-way communication would as is it. This should be very significant to you. Matter of fact, it is. It's fascinating. It means the two-way communication must rank with postulates. It just means that that must be the case. And it must be that either you make a postulate or you two-way communicate, see? And if you've made a postulate, then two-way communication will as is the postulate. This is quite fantastic, you see? Because there isn't any mass about which I know anything that will not at least thin on two-way communication, and if you kept it up, would vanish and disappear. No mass anywhere. One of these interesting factors. Now, therefore, we must have a considerable vested interest in two-way communication. If we have such a vested interest in it, it must be awfully important. And if it as is masses put up by anyone, and we get to the other point, it certainly is doubly important, because here is the other oddity. Two-way communication as is a mass, whether it's put up by Joe or Bill, and whether run by Joe or Bill or Tom and Susie. See? It just doesn't matter who runs the two-way communication or who put up the mass, so we are at once, and I've just gotten this sorted out neatly, we're at once above the level of ownerships. So then we're above the level of causation. We must be above the level of who made it. And the question, who made it, is also solved by two-way communication. We don't even have to hit who made it to get it going by the board. So we have two systems at work here, and one of the systems requires great precision, such as perfect duplication, assignment of the exact ownership, the mocking up or unmocking of masses by postulate. Here's this hugely complicated system. That all goes under the heading of postulates, mock-ups, and all that, you know. And here's another independent system. And it's an independent system. Don't try to interrelate these two things. You can, of course, put them on the scale of seniority or parallel or anything you want. But they really are not related systems. Two-way communication. Two-way communication. Now, there's a great deal of liabilities to the use of communication which create circumstances, not necessarily the same circumstances as the first class. Now, the first class which we speak is this ramification of postulates, mock-ups, misowning, all kinds of oddities like this, you see. Now, there's that class. And now we have another way of making masses is start knocking off parts of the two-way communication formula. And that's the second class. Now, these two classes, then, either one makes or unmakes masses. Postulates, creativeness, perfect duplicates, ownership, discovery of exact causation. You understand? These make and unmake spaces and masses, and also time. That's one class. Now, the other class, just make sure you get this real good, the other class is two-way communication, as-is's, and failures on the two-way communication system. In other words, only part of the formula in use creates masses and spaces, too. So you can create masses and spaces with use of or neglect of some part of the two-way communication formula. You can create masses and spaces, weirdly enough, over here in this first class, you see. In other words, we have two independent systems at work, and the two systems monitor each other and modify each other. See? That is the way it is. Now, when you look at somebody's bank, you realize then two things could be wrong with this bank. Two things. See, it's there by misownership, and it's all gummed up because of misownerships of confusions and shame, blame, and regret, you know, and kicking it back and forth, and failure to locate the exact causes of things, and failure to exactly remember things. Get that in there. Although that really isn't germane to that. I'm going to talk about that in a moment. We have all of these things that could accumulate and disrupt the bank. In other words, postulates, misownerships, active, forthright creation and uncreation of masses and spaces. And then we've got this other system here that a fellow starts to engage in two-way communication and spaces and masses result or get as is, depending on whether or not you used full two-way communication or partial two-way communication. Now, you see that? See, there's another system by which we get masses. Isn't it fascinating that there are two systems? Well, there aren't just two systems. There's three. There's a third system, which is independent of the other two systems, which monitor and modify both of them. And that is the first postulate system. Axiom 36. This is another independent system. We can tell lies on the first, second postulate basis, and we will then create and uncreate in various ways spaces and masses, and also, of course, for all of these time. Now, in other words, we make a... Here's the native state, and the fellow kicks out one of his abilities with the first postulate. Then he makes a second postulate as to the specification, classification of the ability, and we get, as a result of this activity, we get masses resulting, you see? We get a resultant mass, a resultant space, a resultant time. Here's another way of making time and mass, which is not necessarily dependent at all on the first two classes. So class three is all there by itself, very nicely, very neatly. It would probably keep on that way forever, you see. You could know and not know various things, and you would get a resultant series of interesting factors involved. Now, you understand what I mean? I mean, you'd get a mass. Anytime you say, well, I don't know, you know, I don't know about women. Well, I know women are pretty doggone nice. Gotta have a mock-up. Here's a mechanical system. See that? He gets a mass or a space or both with his second postulate. Quite cute. Now, he can forget and remember the resulting mass, and he gets this curiosity of another way to create a universe. See, we've got now three ways to do this same thing. All right. The odd part of it is that any one of these systems monitors the other two. Now, those are the three principal systems. There may be other systems. I haven't taken time to look around and classify them at this juncture. There may be other systems. But the great oddity is that none of these systems need to be resorted to if you're going to take them apart. Postulates and considerations take apart the third class. You can add to or unmock the masses resulting from the lie just by consideration change. This first and second postulate system, in other words, can be monitored by that. The first and second postulate system can be monitored by two-way communication. It'll add to or subtract from masses resulting because of axiom 36. The first, second postulate system. Quite curious. Quite curious. So if there are these three classes, then we had better look at which classes are worthwhile and useful in processing. And we find out all three classes are. But we find out this terrific oddity. Unless we rehabilitate the ability in class one, we get no resurgence on the part of the preclear. Awfully important for an auditor to know. In other words, although considerations are not absolutely necessary, evidently, for two-way communication and so forth, there's some sign that these classes 2 and 3, and that's why they're listed as classes 2 and 3, are resultant from and dependent upon considerations themselves, postulates and considerations. You see that? Because of these three classes, although they're very neat, and although they're very nice, and although they handle masses, and although they get things out of the road, which the preclear can put out of the road and lay aside, you see. Although they create and uncreate masses, spaces, time, keep a universe going or knock one out, and so on, they nevertheless are evidently dependent on the ability to consider in class one. See, they're evidently dependent upon that factor. Now, where do we get the most gain in a preclear? It should strike you as odd that we can change his intelligence or change his personality. Either or. And when I found out originally that we could change his intelligence or change his personality, I became very curious. And I wondered what changed his personality and what changed his intelligence. See that? Now, wherever and however we work this system of processing, we should know whether we're changing personality or improving intelligence. Now, the odd part of it is that all three of these things, in the regain of their abilities, have a tendency to alter both the personality and the intelligence. See, all three classes have an effect on doing this. Now, wherever we have a system, we, of course, have something junior to a consideration. That's the way it is, and we're stuck with it. See that? All right. It must follow, then, that these systems are the result of considerations. You mock up something because you consider that it is there. You unmock it because you consider that it is unmocked. See? And now in classes 2 and 3, which is why they have junior numbers, that is to say they're 2 and 3, not class 1, we find that within the bounds of existing agreements, you see, within the bounds of existing agreements, a past series of agreements are at work. Out of class 1, then, we get a certain pattern of agreements which bring us up to and straighten out difficulties or actually create more difficulties in classes 2 and 3. Now, we have, then, a series of thoughts which have to do with class 1 and are intimately and are derived from class 1. We obtain then workable systems. And we could say that Scientology as class 4 is such a workable system. See this? We've done a fantastic thing here. Actually, within the realm and framework of universes, we have actually created another system which, by certain practices, agreements, and considerations, can make and unmake space, make and unmake mass, and make and unmake time. If you don't believe this, you ought to see how much junk you can make a fellow accumulate by bad auditing. You actually create new masses. You give him stops and changes at the wrong parts of a session. You fail to engage in enough two-way communication and so on. And this fourth class is certainly older. I mean, pardon me, it's newer, you might say. It's more years deep from year zero than classes 2 and 3. Now, it's very, very strange that this class 4 would handle classes 1, 2, and 3. And yet, obviously, cannot be senior to classes 1, 2, and 3, because class 4 simply uses and handles the existing sets of agreements and abilities. Now, then we're up against a very great curiosity. Class 4 is able to control and monitor classes 1, 2, and 3. And class 4 is Scientology. Now, there may be some other systems that we wot not of, or that are peculiar, germane to some other universe. See, there may be other systems. This may be. So, we should, of course, allow ample space in there. So, we should just say the nth class is Scientology. And we shouldn't call it class 4. Or the xth class. Maybe that's better. It's the xth class. Almost impossible to say, therefore you'll remember it. Well, let's just name it there. And let's put it as one of these classes. And the reason we're going to put it as one of these classes is we actually can create and uncreate spaces, masses, and time with this stuff. You can create an independent Scientological time track for an individual just between auditor and very clear if you don't follow the better practices of auditing and create an individual time track. To that degree, you're creating a universe. You can throw enough auditor code breaks into the situation to create artificial masses which actually don't come under the heading of 2 and 3 intimately, because they're under the headings of 1, 2, and 3 all at once, and therefore we get this X class. So there may be other systems and classes, so we just better leave a space in there, and we say to date, we know of these classes. Class 1, by postulates and considerations, the making and unmaking of spaces, masses, time, associations, agreements, so on. Class 2, the making and unmaking of spaces and classes by use of or neglect of two-way communication. That's an easy one to remember where it is, because it's class 2, two-way communication. And class 3... And class 3 is the native state, first postulate, second postulate system. And class X is anything you've learned since 1950. Curiosity itself. That we would actually be dealing with something which is best used as a standard class. It is best used as it. Because it's another breed of cat, we have done the unthinkably, incredibly impossible thing of standing up above class 1. The use of postulates and considerations in order to create and uncreate spaces, masses, and time and universes. See that? If we can handle class 1 with Scientology, then Scientology at least belongs in the same class of classes. At least belongs in that same class. It's another system of agreements, though. And the simplicity of it all is that the pre-clear changes most and changes best when you win in class 1. Got that? When you win in class 2, you have caused energy to get him to change his mind in the bank. Well, you still win, but you're winning subordinate to a set of agreements derived from class 1. And now, native state, first postulate, second postulate systems, and so on, of course, don't underestimate these. They do change the pre-clear. See? These states of change are subordinate to, actually, the two-way communication state, because they have to be done with a two-way communication basis. And actually, the X-th class may or may not be senior to or junior to the other three classes, for the good reason that it uses the other three classes. And only works because of class 1, but would work even if you didn't have class 2 and class 3. If we didn't know class 2 and class 3, we'd still get some workability, and have. I'm perfectly prepared to find 89 classes, stretching out all of them, however, subordinate to, if you please, class 1. Even class X is subordinate to 1. Because if we neglect cognition, for instance, that's where that belongs, class 1, if we neglect cognition on the part of the preclear, if we neglect his increase of understanding as represented by his increase of ARC, you see, which is, again, merely a new postulate on his part, or a new created state as far as he's concerned. If we neglect the ability to mock up or unmock at will by postulate alone, we have a limited win. The only way to get an unlimited win would be by class 1 and class X. With class 1 eventually as-ising class X. Got that? And unless class 1 as-ises class X eventually, the fellow comes to the cognition, well, I don't need any more auditing. I'm in beautiful condition. Things are going along fine, unless he makes such a consideration and says, well, I don't need any more. We haven't won. Totally. we have won subordinate to class X. Let me call to your attention that psychoanalysm never at any time got any higher. Is that the subject of their activity? I thought it was. Excuse me if I'm wrong. I'm just being scientifically factual. I don't see why you're laughing. They never became higher than the subject itself, you see. Everyone had to be continued in a psychoanalysis. Got the idea? In order to get along, he had to be psychoanalyzed forever. All right, we don't want to fall into this trap in Scientology. We can, of course, actually live rather well as far as making masses and spaces and so forth, and time tracks and everything else, subordinate to class X. We actually can do all right with getting an occasional patch-up of auditing. All right, now, we have to ask this question then. Is there a make-and-break point? Or have we created a new Frankenstein? Now, the Frankenstein monster effect is just that. And this is an old term, by the way. It's quite important. It is that thing which dissuades people from doing further creation. It is the effect which damps out creativeness. The Frankenstein monster effect. By the way, you know, the monster was never named Frankenstein. Frankenstein was the name of the builder of the monster, the creator of the monster. And Frankenstein's monster was built lock, stock, and barrel by this gent Frankenstein out of old body parts that had been kicking around in deep freeze or something. And wired up, why, the Frankenstein monster, of course, as you all know, went romping and enjoying nothing, but went romping across the land, stripping the limbs from little children as though he were taking petals from flowers and doing other thoughtless things. And nobody could stop him. There was no way you could kill the Frankenstein's monster. Not being alive, it couldn't be made dead. See that? And the monster, therefore, became a terror to all beholders and so on. It was an indestructible thing, and it had no soul, no mores, no ethics, and so forth. A general or something like that. You think I'm being too hard on generals, I know, but then you probably haven't known any personally. I have. A general that is too busy to look over his morning mail, and so a young fellow gets shot. The first man to be shot for desertion in the United States Army since about 1862, something like that, is shot because a general is too busy with his golf clubs or something or whatever he was doing on the Western Front to look over what he's signing. So a young fellow who was quite neurotic and who'd simply didn't know which way he was going, get shot. You know? A general who says, bomb that town. Bomb it to smithereens, because undoubtedly there are lots of enemy hulking in the rubble and so forth. And you get into the town and find out it was occupied by one school full of school children, most of whom are now dead and the rest wounded. And who says, well, tactical blunder. Go on, boys. Let's get on with the war. You know, inhumanity incarnate. And a Frankensteinian monster, this, by the way, is not germane to one general. This is the characteristic of a man who will actually consent to continuing a destruction as the head of what is laughingly called a set of troops. See? And have a lot of reasons why all this has to take place and sincerely dedicate himself to destruction. Totally. Without consulting the self-determinism or decency of the race. And I think that man is a pariah. I think that man must be utterly craven and depraved. I don't care what army he's in or in what age he lived. That's my idea, and that's why you all of a sudden hear me coming down once in a while with a boot heel on generals. They don't make a good game, they simply end them. Their motto is the same motto an Engram Bank has. We must overcome self-determinism by force. And if we sufficiently overcome everybody's self-determinism by force, we will then have, and they've never asked themselves what. Now, we train these boys and turn them loose. And then the next thing you know, they're yappity-yapping back and forth, and the next thing you know, the private citizen has a war on his hands in which he isn't interested. We've actually, to that degree, created a Frankenstein's monster. We've created a man who knows nothing of diplomacy, knows nothing of life, and we have put into his hands a great many young men who have been lied to and trained in one way or another. And they go out and kill a lot of other young men and a lot of civilians, too. And if this is a way of life, I have never noticed any life in it, only death. Yet the world, having created this particular type of monster, is faced today with the problem of how do you uncreate this monster? How do you uncreate this general whose totality of existence depends upon threat and continuance of war? See? How do we uncreate this character? How do we uncreate this whole philosophy of war? Now, we could say there's a philosophy of war, and the philosophy of war has created the general, and we would be right. A sort of a group postulate has come up here, and the mass and space and time which it created is the general and his army. Now, the only way the race is trying to, as is this thing, is to create other generals and other armies and have them try to obliterate the existing generals and armies who came about because of this postulate. You get the idea now, Now, this is not a political speech I'm making. Probably be hanged for it in about 20 countries on Earth, to say the least. But if they did hang me, they'd certainly get a lot of publicity. Probably the only reason I'm alive today. Anyhow, it'd make more noise to hang him than let him talk. Now, I want to give you this as an example, not out of the depth of bitterness of my soul, but out of the depth of bitterness of your bank. Because you felt far worse than that from time to time about a Frankenstein's monster. You made it. And it kept on going, and you couldn't do anything to knock it off. You get the idea? You were party to some act or creation which then could not be made to stop. Just like Frankenstein, you see. You made this mock-up in this space and time and so on, and you said, that's cute, now it's walking fine, and you said, now stop walking, you said. And it kept on walking. And you said, cease, vanish. And it didn't cease. And it didn't vanish. And a situation more or less of your own creation became more and more arduous and persisted further and further. And it seemed that your very efforts to unmock it, to crush it, to wipe it out, made it more awesome and more terrible. Just like the effort to crush generals and armies today. And the force of arms of various nations is becoming more awesome and more terrible. You see that? Till a man trying to suppress the survival of one of these Frankenstein monsters then gets into this fantastic consideration that he must suppress and must himself kill in some fashion. And if he cannot do it in any other fashion, he will do it with force. A man who has, through his connection with a woman, brought her to a level of activity and pain and hurt of which he is fully ashamed, finds he cannot uncreate this monstrous situation. He has put the devil of pain, you might say, inside of her to such a degree. He's disarranged her. He's given her some sort of an off-balance insanity, and he would do anything to uncreate this. And he cannot. And therefore, out of franticness, like the Ballad of Reading Jail, he may shoot her. Or stab her. You understand? You see the excess of passion to which an individual may come in an effort to knock out a Frankenstein monster. He himself has created the monster. He knows that it may have had other bases. There may have been other provocations. But at the same time, he did create it. The American people today are shuddering with shame over Hiroshima. They've stopped talking about it, but they haven't stopped feeling about it. It's a fantastic thing. This bomb was turned loose against something, and they have created it, and now they're trying to settle this problem, and it doesn't settle, it doesn't resolve, because the only thing that will resolve it is something of equal magnitude, they say, which is other bombs. And out of this spark alone, we may have a national suicide complex, because the country we bombed had a national suicide complex. You follow me? So the Lord knows what would happen to an individual who started out at all costs to knock out a Frankenstein monster. A war that he has, through his own stupidity, nursed and nurtured into full red blossom, you see? And he wants to do something about it, and he just makes more war. A reactive bank which has more or less been created, and you want to do something about it, and all you do is make more reactive bank. The idea? You decide to dramatize these engrams, and maybe they'll go away that way. And if I just let myself go and let myself rage the way I seem to feel that I have to do from something inside me, maybe it'll all go away. And you haven't, it hasn't all gone away. You've just got another lock on the same engram. See? Dramatization actually is a mechanism by which the individual seeks to wipe out his reactive bank. If we put a person into a position where he can, by an old psychotherapeutic term, abreact his hostilities, we feel that he will be better off, and he doesn't get better off. He may have little pressure on him as a result for quite a while, but the next thing you know, why, the bank caves in on him just the same. In other words, here we have the anatomy of the decay of an individual or of any dynamic, or man himself, or this universe. It's the creating of something. Now, be very sharp on this. Not all the histrionics in the world could put this across. It's just the creating of something which then becomes uncreatable. You get the idea? It cannot be discreated. It's the creating of something which you cannot then discreate, if you will take an invented term. Somehow or another, it started up. And somehow or another, you want to stop it, or control it further, or unmalk it. And you fail all the way along the line. And the failures, as they pile up, simply bring about a conviction on the part of the individual, not that he cannot create, and that would be the wrong computation to use if you were treating a young writer or painter or musician who no longer wrote or painted or composed. It's not that he cannot create. It's that he dare not create. Got it? He dare not create. The rehabilitation of the ability to create is the only thing which can bring an individual out of the shambles. And he dare not create, because those things he creates, he feels, he cannot uncreate. Follow me? And under this entire stress walks man. If anyone wanted to make a summation that had nothing to do with our technical terms or anything, you could say, he must not create, since he knows that that which he creates will become a monster to everyone. Actually, you really have no problems of your own. They are all other people's problems. See, they really are all other people's problems. Death will come and you will be 180 yards back of your head as it lies there bloody and battered, and you will say, well, I'll not know that hole works. And that's that. Maybe it will take you a few years of sitting on a piece of space dust to not know it all. you know. But eventually you will say, oh, well, what the dickens, and pick up another mock-up or get back in the game again, one way or the other, but usually diffidently, since you know too well that if you now create anything, it will become a monster. It's almost as if you cannot suffer, but insist you can by being the other thing which you believe is suffering. You follow that? But the creation of the monster is an unsolved problem, because the creation of anything may become an unsolved problem if it cannot be discreated. We desire an illness to stay home from school, and then one fine day we realize we're really sick, and the body is really sick, you see. You wanted it to be sick once, but now it's really sick. And you say, well, now, sickness, discreate at once. The body goes right on coughing. And you say, well, I didn't make that sickness originally. See? As a matter of fact, you have disobeyed the third class at once, you see. You've gone into the soup. You have said, ha-ha, first postulate. And then you've given it the real lie. This is the most tangled postulate system you can get into. Native state, first postulate, second postulate, directly controverting the first postulate. Native state, well, first postulate, sick. Second postulate, not sick. Get the idea? But it's made as a second postulate because it's directed at a particular illness. Therefore, when you process significances... You might pick this up this morning real quick. When you process significances, you're laying in second postulates on sickness, you see. You follow that? You're being very specific. You're saying, oh, that first postulate there, not so. And the fellow goes on being sicker. You see, so you just really shouldn't process various sicknesses. Some specific sickness. Process, if you please, the subject of sickness, if you wish. But even then, you may have a hard time. Process, if you wish, the mechanics of how sickness comes about. But even then, you may have a hard time. Because remember that you're processing each time against a specific first postulate. First postulate said, I am sick. It also said sickness is possible. And now, you on second postulate, you're starting to say, that sickness is curable. Okay? So it's a lie. Because the first postulate was that it existed. Yeah. Now, on first and second postulate systems, you could handle sickness if you simply looked over this and you realized that the fellow was not using health. You get the idea? He's first postulating against health. That's what he's first postulating. See? So, to run out the first postulate, you have to rehabilitate his ability to say, I am sick, I am sick, I am sick, see. That sick, that sick, that sick, that sick, that sick. See, it isn't a contrary or upsetting contradictory here. It's the fact that if you say, he says, now I am well, I no longer have jaundice, I no longer have another dreadful disease the society has, and no longer have jurisprudence. And, I no longer have the... See, it'll become a lie, and lies become solid. And you get a solidity out of the first and second postulate system. See that? So you'd either have to rehabilitate his first or second postulate, or, if you please, you would have to create by mock-up, certainly, sick terminals and get him to end them until he regained his confidence concerning the Frankenstein monster effect. You create a sickness and uncreate it. Create it and uncreate it. Create it and uncreate it. In mock-up form. See? Create it and uncreate it. All of a sudden you say, somebody dare mention the fact that one is sick, because that postulate could be uncreated. You eventually heave a real sigh of relief on this basis. And if you wanted to be a great healer, and only a great healer, you possibly could follow this system exclusively with no other system, beyond possibly some sort of two-way communication or a sympathetic attitude, wouldn't matter much. If we wanted to be a great healer, you would simply, in mock-up form, get the guy to end what he made in creative form, you see, until he overcame the Frankenstein monster effect. You see that? We find before us the whole world engaged in trying to end war with war. We find in every preclear, actually, in a sick preclear, the whole preclear, practically, dedicated to trying to end aberration or malfunction with aberration and malfunction. See? And he doesn't think he can stop it. Therefore, he has to use force against it. You follow me now. All you'd have to do would be to remedy this individual's discreativeness, to return to him his creativeness. Now, remember that as long as we say this individual cannot create mock-ups, things, stuff, you know, all the fellows, by the way, who cannot create mock-ups, that's for the birds. He can create mock-ups. All of these people, you see, come into this group, and if this individual is treated from this basis, that he cannot create mock-ups, you will fail. You will fail inevitably because you're using the wrong postulate. Use this one and you'll win. He dare not create mock-ups. You got it? He dare not. And the reason why he dare not is the Frankenstein monster effect. If he creates something, he knows he can't stop it. This individual also has the feeling that if his right hand started shaking, he would not be able to stop it except try to hold it still. You got the idea? And you got St. Vitus dance and such a deal. Right hand. Got it? So he daren't start acting in an aberrated fashion because he knows if he did, he would not be able to stop it. You got it? So he has to walk with careful sanity through all of his days. See, he cannot create a condition and then discreate it, so he has to be very careful what situations he creates. All right, now we got that? You got that? Then the remedy of mock-ups, the remedy of the ability to create, the remedy of the ability to create universes, and therefore the remedy of complete dependency and parasitic existence alongside of and upon everything else which already exists, you see that, would come to an end. And there are many people so parasitic as to drive you half out of your mind. You know that they will come in and use your toothbrush. They have to use your toothbrush. They can't use theirs. See that? They must be parasitic. They have 20 pounds in their pocket. You see? But they cannot, at any moment, spend any part of it. They have to borrow 5, 10, 15, 20 pounds from you, see, to spend it. You get the idea? This is very curious. Now, having done that, they cannot pay it back. Why can't they pay it back? Because it would unparasiticize them. You see this? So they become more and more dependent upon already created things. And what things are going forward in this universe? What things can be depended upon absolutely and completely to be there and to continue in operation? The Frankenstein monsters. The thing which can continue in operation then is therefore that thing which nobody has been able to discreate. And the things which they're unable to discreate are, for the most part, Frankenstein monsters. Got it? So it could become a very horrible universe. It could have a dwindling spiral, you see. It doesn't have to have, however. It doesn't have to go on that spiral at all. And people do not have to become parasitic. You see? An individual, a Thetan, who believes that his total force and energy must come from the sun or from an electric power line is nuts. but he dare not create any energy, and he dare not do anything but take it off the power line, because if he did, he himself would have created a Frankenstein's monster. If we evaluate this from the standard world belief that people hurt people, and that people intend to hurt people, we will miss, to some degree, even so, in these computations, because we'll believe that pain is intentionally, always intentionally delivered. Do you know what life really thinks of pain? It thinks when somebody hurts a mock-up of one kind or another that it must have been a mistake. See, nobody could have had that intention. And therefore, it must have been a mistake. And that is the first thought that a child has, for instance. You step on a child, the child immediately assumes it must have been a mistake on your part. He protests, but he protests to tell you that you've made a mistake. You got it? And out of this comes the Frankenstein monster idea. You made this mock-up. You didn't make it for any particular evil purpose. You might have just made it for somebody's amusement, you see? And then it runs into somebody, and they know very well what your intention was, and yet they're afraid it'll mess up their mock-ups, see? So they then say, yai, 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 and give the complete illusion of pain and damage. And they're telling you, you made a mistake making that thing. And you say, because you can't experience it subjectively, at once, you say, I must be hurting them in some fashion or another. One of the most alarming things which you can do to a child or a dog is when they come around to rub up against you or swat you or anything else in play, you see, is to suddenly start howling or crying. Stop, stop, ow, 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 you know. Of course, they'll recognize this as a game very shortly, but they're quite upset for a moment. They look you over and say, what did I do? And now you don't keep on in convincing them. You kind of grin at them through the ow, ow, ows, and they say, oh, this is a gag. I recognize this gag from a long time ago. But if you were to actually pretend that you were horribly wronged and upset, whether you were or not, the child would become upset and would become less active. Now, sometimes a child is very hard to convince on this basis. And they pound you around mercilessly before they finally get the conviction that they actually are hurting you. They don't believe it at first. But when they find out they really are hurting you, they quit. The day that some activity becomes totally convinced that people can be hurt, some activity that hurts people, that people can be hurt, they will stop it. See? So therefore, people work hard at convincing people they can be hurt, and this is the betrayal effect. People are going around saying, betrayed, betrayed, betrayed. It is possible to betray people. It is possible to hurt people, you see? It is possible, and they're saying, ow, 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 ow. You get the idea? And if they say, ow, 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 enough, then people won't let Frankenstein monsters loose on them because they are already aware of the fact that things cannot be discreated, which are harmful. So they're keeping everyone posted that they better not create any Frankenstein monsters that simply go around chewing people up. Out of all of these involved considerations, by the way, comes the subject of pain itself. Pain is a conviction. It's a great oddity, but pain is a conviction. I know it does nobody any good to hear this if he's lying there screaming. He hurts. See, he hurts. And it's really painful. He can feel it. And you say, well, if you walk over to it, you're from some church or something of the sort, and you say, well, pain is just all an idea. It happens to be that that's true, you see. Pain is all an idea. But they don't add this. Pain is all an idea which has become agreed upon to such an extent back down the track that it is real as walls. Get the idea? They leave the bridge out, and therefore the explanation sounds silly. All right. people tell people, ow, 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 in an effort to get people off of them, keep them from turning loose these monsters. And so people become convinced that more monsters can be turned loose than are turned loose. And so they again impede their own creativeness. They hear this, ow, ow, ow. They read the newspapers, which are saying, ow, ow, ow. See? And they read this, and whether pain was or was not there, or any truth was or was not there, they get the idea, you see, that more pain exists than does exist. And they get this terrific conviction, re-stimulated over and over and over, that Frankenstein monsters can be turned loose, and they themselves have been surprised many times in mocking something up which they couldn't unmock. And so, therefore, in the receipt of all this bad news, all of which, by the way, is hearsay, somebody said that, I've gotten exact words with respect, that all the criticism or all the comments, the bad statements that people made always come secondhand. You never hear them from the person himself. That's always, you know, good roads and good weather. But any comments you hear about him, he got secondhand, see? You know, there's a distinct possibility that there are practically no first-hand comments. Get the idea? And then comes the possibility that there are very few second-hand comments, but they get manufactured en route. You get the idea? So that you'd have a terrific additive stack of ow, ow, ow in the world, you see? All out of proportion to what was going on in the world. It could be real bad. This is undoubtedly true, you see, that it is bad enough. But bad enough could be added up into, oh, gee whiz, so unbearably bad, you know, on and on and on. In an effort to reach this point of convincing somebody that it is possible to hurt somebody else. And thus we get a self-protective mechanism going through the society, and we get nearly all of it third hand, second hand, third hand, fourth hand, fifth hand, 155th hand, to name the newspapers, see? The newspapers take somebody who can't report, and they put him to chasing down rumors of people who can't talk, and you eventually get the big scandal on the front page, having been passed through the linotype operator who can't type. And, of course, it goes through the rewrite man who can't duplicate either. It's hard to tell whether a hurricane or a blonde hit Poughkeepsie. So we get this conviction that mock-ups can be created, which are bad, which cannot then be uncreated by anybody, see? And we get the postulate on the part of people, you see, that they dare not create a mock-up. You got that? And creative processing itself can, used with these understandings, can then rehabilitate the ability of the individual to create. And when it does, it renders him less dependent, less parasitic, more independent and freer, and certainly rids him of a terrific number of guilt complexes. And so we have creative processing working, and today being the first level approached or attacked on level 3 of the steps we are teaching in this fourth London unit. Thank you.